I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about having a healthy heart, healthier than you have now. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Let's get smart about heart health. And there's a reason. Every year, almost, I think it's 750,000 of us in the United States have a heart attack. It's the leading cause of death for men and women, heart disease, accounting for one of every four deaths. I think those numbers are astounding. And these numbers raise important questions about what we can do to improve heart health. You know, what are the facts, the real facts about warning signs that many of us ignore? What is it about those signs that makes us do that? We're not into some kind of victim blaming here, as you know, saying you're stupid if you, but you know, there must be something about the subtlety of these signs, unless it's some crushing pain, that makes us ignore them. And there's probably some psychological aspect too. We'll get into that. I'm wondering if we do, say, three things to help our hearts, what should they be? I've just learned that one of my relatives, a female, has lost her own father at a young age to heart disease. He lost his father at a young age to heart disease, and that father lost his father to heart disease at a young age. And not one of my relatives' doctors has ever worked her up to check on her heart health. Not one, despite that she smokes and has a fair amount of weight on her body. So I'm asking you, have you checked your heart health carefully? Has your doctor, considering that heart disease is the leading vulnerability for all of us? So let's get smart in this hour and do our part to the extent that we can for our own health. Dr. Annabel Rodriguez is here from UConn Health in Farmington, Connecticut. She is a professor at the medical school, holds the Linda and David Roth Chair for Cardiovascular Research. She comes to UConn from Johns Hopkins. Her lab at UConn is focused on genetics. Yes, there's a role here for the heart and genes. So coming up, we also have, a little bit later in the show, lifestyle adjustments that affect heart health positively. Dr. Rodriguez, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're hearing so much about targeted gene therapies for all kinds of diseases. Is this also the future for heart medicine?
Yes, I think so in a broad sense. I want to be very clear that right now we still don't actually have therapies that say we've identified this genetic problem that you have and we know how to correct it, say, through fancy genetic engineering, right? That we're not there yet. And there are actually some concerns being raised about doing sort of genetic engineering that we still really need to resolve, both from a moral perspective and then just, is that really working? But what we do know is what are changes that are occurring in our DNA sequences, the basis of life, right? This DNA code that we have that we inherit from our parents. Think of it sort of as beads on a string of pearls, and each little pearl has a special code to it. There are actually four codes. It's a G, a C, an A, and a T, right? And they repeat themselves on this strand of pearls that twist in a double helix and a loop. So let's say, for instance, that the gene that I've been studying for a while relates to the healthy cholesterol fraction. And I'll speak to your viewers about how we came to that. But what happens is if, say, the normal sequence is G, 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 say, four G strung beads on a strand, mm-hmm. strand of pearls. And then someone else has a G, G, C, G, right? So they have the three Gs, but they're only one little switch from a G to the C. What we found is that little tiny switch can actually make a huge difference about your risk for heart disease, in our case, related to the healthy cholesterol fraction.
So can you look at our DNA sequencing? You can look at it.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. That's how we found out doing it was I saw a patient some years ago when I was in Baltimore named Clara. So Clara was referred to me by her primary care physician because – The physician was, do I treat Clara? She has elevation in her blood for the lousy cholesterol, the LDL, but her healthy cholesterol is also really quite high. So is the healthy cholesterol beating out the lousy cholesterol? Do I need to treat her with medications? And Clara herself, like many of us, I'll include myself in this as well, that we're not really big fans of taking medications unless it's really necessary. I think we're all kind of good.
What a good question this is. So what did you do?
Yeah, so as I evaluated Clara, so talked to her, found out about her family history. She, too, had a very strong family history for heart disease and strokes, with many of her siblings in their 40s having problems. Mm. And then on physical exam, as physicians do the physical exam, you can look for areas in the body to see if there's excess cholesterol deposition. And one of the things, you know, deposits within the blood vessel or on skin, one of the places that we look for is you put the stethoscope over the neck,
yeah,
and you listen for what looks like obstructed. It sounds like obstructed blood flow. We call it a brewery. If I can make the sound, it actually goes like this. So if you hear it, then we know when we're listening, there is some blockage within your artery that we can hear, and that's what she had. So it's called, she had a carotid brewery, this obstruction.
Yeah. So
she had a very high level of the healthy cholesterol and high levels of the lousy cholesterol. So we set about to try to understand this is a strong genetic component given her family history. On physical exam, she had evidence for atherosclerosis, this kind of long mm-hmm. name for accumulation of cholesterol in the blood vessels.
So when you start adding it up, adding up the evidence, the pieces of that evidence, like a detective, you start to say, And were you able to sequence her genes her DNA and see what did it tell you? Abnormal chain?
That's right. So what happens is that you can get DNA from your blood, a simple blood draw. You can isolate the DNA, use new technology today that you can look at that sequencing. We call it the code on that strand of pearls or those, the GGC like that. We could do that and we could identify that she had a change in this one region that you don't see in the vast majority of people.
So you said, that's it for you, sister. You're going on these drugs.
You're going on Medicaid. That's exactly right. You have the family history. On physical exam, we can tell that the healthy cholesterol is not beating out your lousy cholesterol because you have this brewery. And then we can see that in this region that of the gene that affects the healthy cholesterol fraction, that this healthy cholesterol fraction, in fact, isn't really healthy for you.
How often does this kind of investigation go on in a regular internist's office or when you go to see a heart specialist? Do most skilled heart doctors do this kind of thing now?
So what I think is really, I think that underscores really, it's a good segue about the importance of biomedical research in the United States. And one of the premier institutions that we have that we support as taxpayers is the National Institutes of Health.
NIH.
And that's critical and it's so unique for us and it's a wonderful gem of our committed dollars for what we support at the government level.
But why are you making that link?
Well, I'm making it because what happens is in academia, like where I was at Hopkins, where I am now at the University of Connecticut, healthcare providers like myself trained to do biomedical research, we want to find answers to the unknown. Why was this lady having heart disease with a high HDL? I did exactly what you did. I went, really? What is that? Well, then we go about to find the answers, and then our clinician partners, the cardiologist, the endocrinologist, the family physician, the internist, they are gathering all this information from what we find out from the unknown. It becomes known, and then that becomes the standard of practice. So it's a great partnership between academia and clinicians.
So let me, though, when I'm asking just to really pinpoint this, is I see where you've got a swarm of multiple intelligences. We'll put it that way. You've got people in different specialties communicating with each other. We see this going on in the field of multiple sclerosis. Mm-hmm. A lot of knowledge being pooled across disciplines to try and solve things. At Yale, they're doing that. So I hear what you're getting at here, at that being important. But is this pretty much a standard? When you describe putting together that genetic, that DNA information with the test for the carotid whooshing thing, plus her cholesterol being high, both good and bad, and this question, is would that be standard practice is what I'm trying to find out.
So I would say no. It isn't standard clinical practice because I think really for clinicians seeing patients daily, they use the partnership with academia to say, help us, like the Clara's primary care physician who referred the patient to me and said, give me guidance. Is this the right pathway? So the primary care physician really astute in saying, this seems very unusual that her HDL is high. We know that you're studying that. Give us guidance. And that's the partnership. But
this speaks to to having an academic research affiliation wherever you're going.
Absolutely.
So I see your point.
Yes.
I also see where tax dollars are going and how important that is, too. Dr. Rodriguez, stay right where you are in that chair. A little bit later on in the show, we're going to be talking about lifestyle changes. I wanted to get at these pinpointed questions so you can see where heart medicine is going at the moment. And we're going to take a short break and come right back with more questions. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for joining us. Interesting show. Annabelle Rodriguez, Dr. Rodriguez is the Roth Chair Holder Professor at UConn Health, directs the Cardiovascular Research Center for Vascular Biology and the Department of Cell Biology at UConn Health, professor at the medical school there. And we're talking about her research. Her thing is genetics and the connection to the heart. Also very interesting, your work on the connection between infertility and women with heart difficulties, and that there is, you're finding, I know you patented something when you were at Johns Hopkins, you're finding a connection there.
Yes.
Wow. I hope we have time to get to that, because I want to say to people, if you are young, right, and having trouble conceiving,
yes,
this is a good workup to get.
Yes.
Because this could be the part of the problem.
Yes,
a
it could be.
Part.
Yes, if I can. So that's exactly right. So Clara was a woman in her 50s with strong family history for heart disease, as we said before, with a high HDL cholesterol. I just want everyone, your viewers who are listening, to know that cholesterol, you sort of see it in the egg yolk if you're eating it. That's where the cholesterol is. But cholesterol is actually a product that our body makes in order to keep our cells intact and our organs intact. And that cholesterol is actually vital for making hormones.
It's a good thing.
It's a good thing. The cholesterol is needed. The molecule is needed to help make estradiol, the female hormone, estrogen, progesterone, which is vital for maintaining an early pregnancy and a pregnancy. A lot of times people forget that cholesterol is the building block for those hormones, and those hormones are essential for fertility, for female fertility. So what was interesting is that when that patient was referred to me, and we knew enough about this gene, it's got a long name, it's called SCARB1 or scavenger receptor class B. Sometimes we call it SRB1. Anyway, that gene, it really influences the cholesterol levels, the healthy cholesterol levels. And what we learned from mice, the work in research with mice, is if they didn't have this receptor at all, they were genetically engineered the mice. Now, none of that receptor. They had very high HDL cholesterol. They develop heart disease if you do the right studies. And the female mice are infertile. So when we started to do our studies, we said, well, we're very interested in whether changes in the genetic code lead to the healthy cholesterol being high and heart disease like Inclara. But we went into the fertility center at Hopkins and we obtained tissue from the women. And we found out that they too, the ones who were having trouble with fertility, had the same genetic mismatch that was leading to the heart attack.
And you patented that test?
Yes,
so that
we
test
did. Yes, and I patented at Hopkins, and what happens in that process is that Hopkins is the owner of the patent. I was a faculty member there as an employee, so I'm the one who comes up with the idea. Hopkins officially owns it.
Yes.
They license it to a company called Iverson Genetics. Iverson now has it available for clinical use, and a colleague of mine at UConn, he's an endocrinologist. His name is Dr. Carl Malkoff. He has been ordering the test for his patients. So
wow.
It is available. It's been clinically validated. And we wanted to do that for the purposes of, it was one thing for me to do it in my lab, but we wanted physicians and healthcare providers to have it available.
This relates to what's coming up next, which is to what extent we influence our heart health.
Yes.
So let me do it this way. We know heart disease is the number one killer, and it's one in, responsible for one in four deaths. It outpaces everything, even cancer. So knowing that, why wouldn't we all? When does the heart start to wear out?
It's
would you
an
say
interesting
is there
question.
An age?
I wouldn't say that there is an age, honestly, because I think that if we do right by our body, if we're good stewards of our body, of what we're born with, understanding the genetics that we have from our parents, but then the things that we do from our environment, like smoking. So with your relative who smokes, that would be a place that would spend a lot of counseling on how do we affect change to stop her from smoking.
So you have your genes. You're working for your genes or you're against your genes. You're helping them or you're hurting them.
Yeah, and I would vote for trying to help your genes.
If
right?
you can.
Yeah,
if you can. So it would seem like organs age out, don't they? I mean, that heart pump is pumping, pumping, pumping. It's a muscle. With age, isn't that?
Yes.
So let's say this. With those women, if you knew early on that women maybe had a history of infertility or a history of heart disease in the family or just individually, would you be able to then work with them at a very young age before reaching fertility to say, look, you are high risk to ensure that you have less of a hard time having children? This is the kind of... These are the lifestyle interventions we would want with you, probably with everybody, but particularly with somebody who's got that vulnerability. Would that be is that where we're going?
Yeah, that's exactly where we'd like to go, and that's what brought me here to Connecticut for the Bioscience Initiative, was to translate our discoveries to commercial entities for the greater good.
For
so
the
that
tests.
Means for therapeutics, or is it a development of a drug, or using functional foods, good nutritious foods that perhaps maybe are like antioxidants. Would they work well in helping to tell people these are the food choices you might want from a younger age?
This is confusing, and we're going to get to Brad Bishop, who is at the Calhoun Cardiology Center Lifestyle Medicine Program Director, coming up in just a little bit. So I look at the CDC map, Center for Disease Control map, that looks at the nation and the world, and it says the most heart disease is in the South, and the least heart disease seems to be in the West, but particularly California. And I'm looking at this map, and I'm thinking, what in the world? Why would this be? Is it food-related? Is it genetically? I mean, how would that geographically turn out to be genetics?
Yes, so you're exactly right. If you look at those maps from the CDC about heart disease risk, but if you were also, say, to superimpose on those maps what has happened to us over the last decades from an obesity rate. You would have seen obesity rates were pretty low, say from the 70s, and really escalate pretty rapidly for obesity rates. Now all states have very high rates of obesity. And so then when you start to introduce risk factors for heart disease, and they include things like your genetics, family history, do you smoke? Are you a man? Do you have a low HDL cholesterol? Do you have trouble with hypertension? Do you have diabetes, pre-diabetes? We did some studies on pre-diabetes. So those are known risk factors that increase your risk for heart disease. When you look at the South, they were probably leading the way for obesity rates and still have some of the highest rates of obesity.
Is that diet?
Well, it's diet. Our food supply is pretty generous. One of my favorite Italian restaurants in Baltimore served us 2-pound pastas as a serving. I mean, that was like a ridiculous amount. So we have food distortion. We have lots of food supply. Think about muffins, of the muffins that you would have had as a little girl when your mom made them for you versus the muffins today that you would buy, or the bagel.
Yeah,
they're supersized. So those portion sizes have been distorted, and that's a lot of calories.
Right, the size of the actual dinner plate has gone up.
But psychological stress from working two or three jobs, from feeling sort of financially at risk, again, choices for smoking, those things, not exercising.
And you also think about the amount of heat in the South, and so people tend to not go outside as much as they would in California.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, some parts of California are sweltering, but you can see, and there's the California cuisine style of eating that is different.
Yes.
But then in the middle of the country, in the Midwest, there's not a lot of heart disease, at least according to the map. And I think to myself, what can that be about? What in the world is going on there if there's all that beef eating in the middle of the country?
Well, some of the other parts that we're studying about risk for heart disease, as I was saying through that list there. But there can be issues about access from disparities, economic disparities. So if the groups from the South have a higher poverty rate, aren't able to get access to care that you might see differently in the middle of the country or on the coasts, those are also contributing to increased risk for heart disease because they're not getting access to the healthcare provider. They're not able to get medications.
Dr. Annabel Rodriguez is here, and she has the Roth Chair for Cardiovascular Research Center at UConn Health. And coming up, we talk with someone from the Calhoun Cardiology Center at UConn Health about more of what we're doing now, lifestyle medicine. So stay with us. We'll open the phones and talk with you, too. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you to our producers, Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol. In the studio with me, Dr. Annabel Rodriguez of UConn Health. She's a professor on the faculty of the medical school in Farmington and also chair of the cardiovascular research department. Her specialty is genetics. She's looking at infertility in women and the connection to issues in the heart. There is a connection, it turns out. And now we're going to say hi to Brad Biskup, who runs UConn Health's Lifestyle Medicine Program. That's part of the Calhoun Cardiology Center at UConn Health. Brad, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So, Dr. Rodriguez, I want to ask a question. And Brad, I want to get your take on this. If you had to name three things that each of us could do to help our hearts be as healthy as they can, what Dr. Rodriguez, what would you say those three things are?
Yes, I would say exercise, don't smoke, and stress reduction.
So some kind of technique that would help with stress reduction.
Yes.
Which exercise does to some degree, and don't smoke. It's interesting you didn't say anything about food, and I know it matters to you because we've just been talking about it, but it's not on your top three list, and that's so interesting to me. If we look at the numbers of people who have heart disease, that it's the number one killer of people. 750,000 people, one in every four deaths, heart disease, heart attack, stroke related. Why wouldn't we all be put on statins at a young age if this is the number one killer? I don't understand this.
Well, so some people do advocate for that, actually, to think about statins in the water, as some have suggested. I think we need to have evidence to really prove that that's the case, and that's the benefit.
What's the case?
That you should be prescribing statins at such earlier and earlier ages. So we know, for instance, for children who have a genetic reason for a high lousy cholesterol, it's a very long name, familial hypercholesterolemia, FH. There is evidence that you should be using statins in that group, and there can be quite young to teenagers. Mm. But someone who doesn't perhaps have a genetic reason like FH, then it's really lifestyle changes and modifications and things that you would do in the home to keep stress down, to exercise, to make good food choices.
Mm-hmm. But tell me why you wouldn't. I'm using, let's say, depression as a model, where if they find that the best combination is talk therapy and drugs. So why isn't it the same with heart disease? You know, why wouldn't you turn great with all the lifestyle stuff? Why wouldn't you also combine that with statins since this is the number one killer?
Yeah, because I think in the evolution of heart disease, you can see evidence within blood vessels this comes from autopsy specimens from as early as age 10. But you won't see the clinical manifestations, that heart attack, that ER visit, until much later, until decades have passed. But if you can really affect change with diet and exercise, that's so much preferable than a prescription for a drug with side effects and office visits and costs that come with it. So I think that's the hesitancy of thinking, let's give statins to everyone at a very young age. Let's be sure that that's the right choice pharmacologically because of what I just said. Office visits, their side effects, and we're not sure that they're necessarily going to work. Why not try diet and exercise?
I want to go to Brad. The only reason I'm not the only reason. One of the main reasons I mentioned this is if we are concerned enough about tooth decay to put fluoride in everybody's water, and that we're talking about the number one killer, why in the world wouldn't we do something with some kind of treatment for the number one killer in the world, I guess?
Well, and if we think of the number one prevention of heart disease is exercise.
Yeah, exactly.
Inactivity is the number one thing that kills people. And a lot of people, they jump to, blood pressure, cholesterol, which are all important, and we kind of skim over the importance of movement.
Mm-hmm.
They think we have to work high intensity. We got to go to the gym. We got to get a sweat up. When you just walk, if you walk an hour a week, you would reduce your risk of cardiovascular events almost 50%, about 40%.
Did you say an hour a week?
A week, not a day. A week. They've done a study and they looked at that, about 40% reduction. And we keep thinking we're looking for we got to work hard, we got to do these extreme things, and just movement.
Yes.
Again, the simplest thing has huge consequences, benefits.
Well, Brad Biscup, by the way, what about this business of the standing desks, the treadmill desk?
Yes.
The treadmill desk I can see because you are moving. Is there real evidence that the standing desk makes a difference?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think of, we keep looking for like a great culture as far as what we should be doing. You look at the Mediterranean diet and how they live. You look at Sardinia, Italy, some of the blue zones is what we call them, people living over 100 years of age. They're moving. They're taking care of their house. They're doing these things. And if you think of when we sit, we lose the normal flow of the blood. And when it doesn't flow regularly, just like an engine, it kind of clogs up over time.
And can you unclog it, Dr. Rodriguez? Let's say you're at, I don't know what age, but the damage has started to be done. If you look at videos, I've heard about videos being shown to interns at Yale Medical School when they're in training, where strips of this plaque that looks like consolidated fat is just being stripped out of veins. It's almost nauseating to see. That's what's happening inside the body, they're saying to these students. This isn't a joke. So if that has already happened, you know, can you use these lifestyle modifications to make a difference in that?
Yes, and so I just also want to agree with what Brad was just saying, too, about exercise and movement, that we know, for instance, from sitting too long, you can develop some of the metabolic changes that happen with prediabetes, or what we call insulin resistance. So it's important for people to get up from their away from their computers and move and stretch for moments instead of constantly sitting for long stretches of time. That's probably really good advice for children with our day and age now with all that gaming and them sitting in front of monitors. Hmm. So I wanted to just completely agree with what Brad had just said. There are some very beautiful data that came from Dean Ornish some time ago. I want to say maybe it's back in the 80s, and I'm sorry if I'm misquoting the actual time, but I think it's from the 80s, where he looked at what we call regression of plaque from these images from coronary arteries, where we could see that there were blockades, and he placed people on some very low-fat diets and then could see that those lesions would go away. They regressed, mm-hmm. and that was spectacular change from a diet intervention. We've been able to see that with drug therapies like the statins that you're talking about. You can usually see regression of lesions. It takes a few years. But there was a study also maybe perhaps now about 10 years ago where they used a form of an HDL molecule, the protein that's called ApoA1. They gave it as an intravenous infusion to men who had had heart disease. And they found that within a period of 1 month's time, there was regression of lesions. So, yes, this mm-hmm. thing that we do to ourselves with misusing our body in the way of not exercising and not making the right food choices and being very stressful and smoking cause damage, but you can have regression.
So, Brad Biskup, we read things constantly. On this show, we try to give people a range of information that's out there and leave it to people in consultation with their health professionals to figure this stuff out as best they can with them. But sitting in this chair, we're just, our minds are just blown because there are so many competing theories.
Correct.
So when you, Brad, what does this come down to for you? What are the solid things that we can rely on?
Well, and you were asking like the three things for heart health. The first thing is movement. The next thing I look at is non-processed plant-based foods. The more you can keep food in its natural form, especially plant-based, the more it works for you. And then the other thing is getting your mind to work for you, which means, you know, dealing with stress, looking at things more in a positive nature. And it's understanding a lot of the stress response. That's preservation. That's the fight or flight response, which unfortunately we don't make those muscles move now like we did, you know, in the caveman days. So it takes its stress out on the organs.
So when each of these books or our experts comes around with all of this evidence to support a particular theory, it is so convincing.
Yeah.
And so I say to you both, how do we know that what you're saying is right? You know, how do we know? You know, we've had people on saying actually fat is not so bad. And high protein is better for the body and, in fact, helps you not to retain weight. And then we hear other people saying, I feel better for some strange reason, not eating gluten. We've got Ornish. We've got every person you could imagine.
Yeah.
What China study? What are we to make of this?
I think if you look at the basis of almost all healthy diets, probably 75, at least 80% are still focused on, you know, plant-based foods that are non-processed. I think if you really looked at it, the majority are still going to focus on that. You know, there are some that are slightly increased more animal-based protein, but not a lot. The majority are just going to be plant-based.
There's been this whole theory, the new thing is inflammation. So now everything seems to be about inflammation. So, Dr. Rodriguez, is there something to this idea of inflammation, or has this now been blown into the reason for everything?
So I think that if you put it in the context again of you're saying that so many people come in and they advocate for their particular position. So how do you know? One day it's one thing, the next day it's something else, and what you thought was true is no longer true. So I'm going to bring it from the perspective of an academic physician, which has been my life career, is that we ask questions, we ask about the unknown, we accumulate this evidence, we want other people to replicate it so that it's larger numbers. Is it the same pattern, the same signal? So what we see then in conclusions, and that what we would use in clinical practice to say this is what we believe is the standard of care best practices, comes from accumulating evidence that we have that this is of benefit. So like the statin, say, for instance, in heart disease. That comes from many, many, many years of doing research in different groups, men, women, around the globe. Yes, this works to reduce the rates for having your first heart attack, or if you've had the first heart attack, reducing the second one, reducing your risk from dying from heart disease. So it comes from accumulating evidence. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to make sure that that's clear because that's my background.
Mm-hmm.
With that in mind, so when you look at things that relate to diet, for instance, the majority of the studies that are out there, and I put this from the perspective of someone who treated many patients with diabetes and cholesterol disorders, is calories count, total calories count. The fat, so the Mediterranean diet has fat in it, right? So that's olive oil as an unsaturated fat. So we learn to say, what are the qualities of those fat? Is it a saturated fat, hard at room temperature, liquid at room temperature like the unsaturated or the polyunsaturated fats? Animal protein like salmon and other sources that are high in the omega-3 fatty acids, really pretty compelling that those products of that omega-3 fatty acids are anti-inflammatory agents. Those are natural products that help to reduce inflammation, and inflammation can be at the heart of what we experience in chronic diseases today like diabetes. So my research work, for instance, has been evolving as we have landed here in Connecticut and doing work on the genetics and what are the therapies for these patients with a genetic cholesterol disorder related to their HDL. We're landed square in that arena of inflammation, and it's exciting to look at the connections of a cholesterol gene to proteins that regulate the immune system that relate to inflammation that are tied to fatty acids like the omega-3 fatty acids that are rich in salmon as an animal protein. So plant-based diets are fantastic to think. This comes straight from the farm, from the garden. I don't have to worry about, can I pronounce the ingredients on the box? Do I know what those things are? To have really very wholesome foods. But I would say it has to be a moderation of all of these, mm-hmm. from protein to different types of fats.
Yes, okay. So Dr. Rodriguez and Brad Biskup, if people are having protein, they like meat, and they have the so-called less fatty kind, you know, the cut that is less fatty, are they okay? You don't, Dr. Rodriguez, you don't have an issue with protein.
I don't, actually. I think that, so I'll put it again from my perspective of patients that I see with diabetes, that sometimes having diets that are rich in carbs, good carbs, bad carbs, whatever you want to say, sometimes they trigger insulin responses that aren't favorable or trigger glucose responses. But if someone eats salmon, tuna fish, turkey, chicken, tofu, soy, these are all high in protein, they don't trigger that same insulin response that has all those bad mm-hmm. consequences to it. So I would counsel my patients to make sure that they had a protein as part of their meal, green leafy vegetables, good carbohydrates, a well-balanced meal.
Uh-huh. Brad, you agree, no doubt.
The main thing is looking, you know, when I look at the labels on foods, and I'm really looking at the protein and fiber content, because like Dr. Rodriguez is saying, with that glycemic or the sugar effect of foods, the lower the glycemic effect, the lower sugar effect, the more stable your blood sugar is, and actually the more satisfied you are with, you know, when you're eating. And that's why, you know, getting the foods, you know, that are like the beans, we forget about the legumes, the nuts, you know, in moderation. Those are all very low glycemic foods.
So let me come around and ask the bad girl question. And that question is, if you did take statins, you know, I mean, the joke, of course, in around the heart docs is that there's a fair number on statins and they're eating whatever they want in the restaurant. So when you are on statins, what is it that the statin is doing to counteract even the bad things you're eating? I mean, do statins allow you to eat foods that are more inflammatory or filled with the bad kind of fat and you're okay? Or do they not cancel that out? What's the truth of it, Dr. Rodriguez? Do you know?
I was hoping Brad would go first.
Okay, Brad, go ahead.
I'll follow you up.
You walk to the firing line.
I think the main thing is it's not just one thing. You know, everybody puts their, says, okay, it's just the statins. It's not just one thing that causes the progression of that plaque, that atherosclerosis. It's, you know, a multitude of different things, the blood pressure, the cholesterol, the smoking, you know, the diet, the inflammatory foods, you know, the inactivity. So to say it's one thing, it never is. And that's why when a patient comes in, we talk specifically, what are you eating? What is your activity? And then we look at the lab work and we talk about, do we need more statin to bring down your cholesterol? Do we need to, how can we bring up that good cholesterol a little bit more? So it's all those little things. And sometimes when we throw everything into just a miracle drug, you know, it's not going to help us long term.
It, what I would say is that the cardiologists are human, and they'll take that statin, and it's a rationalization for going ahead to have mac and cheese and steak and French fries and cheesecake for dessert. So what I would say is that it's always in this kind of realm of how we affect change, when you're ready to make changes, to allow yourself some forgiveness in days and times, perhaps when you're not the most adherent. So I was never punitive with my patients. So I knew anniversaries were important, Thanksgiving's important, what, you know, things like that, birthday parties. So what the statins do is that they lower your lousy cholesterol in your bloodstream. They do have anti-inflammatory properties as well. So it's not just simply by lowering that lousy cholesterol level. We call it pleiotropic effects, but they do have anti-inflammatory effects. So for the most part, taking the drug every day, well-timed, so it's in your body at the same time, it's well-distributed, is of great benefit to you. On occasion, it's your anniversary for your wedding once a year, and you feel like having chocolate lava cake, it's okay. It's really okay. It's when that chocolate lava cake is every day that becomes a problem.
Yeah, more's the pity. okay, so Brad, you're saying for your top three things, mostly plants. Hey, how about this, Dr. Rodriguez, before we run out of time, and Brad, for you too. What are we supposed to do about the weird symptoms of heart attacks? You know, crushing pain in the chest where you're falling down on your knees is one thing. But the range of symptoms, how strange they are, especially for women, nausea, pain in your back, you know, sometimes your arm, headaches, strange, strange things. How in the world are we supposed to keep track of this?
Well, what I would say is that I think, you know, as women we age, that especially after the menopause, our risk for heart disease goes up higher, that female hormones not benefiting us as it had when we were younger, is that for women to not feel embarrassed about going to seek help right away because time matters. There's been evidence, lots of studies to show that women tend to delay. They wait to for someone to come home or wait to call the physician.
And aren't there studies that men don't delay, but they drive themselves?
That's right. Men don't delay, maybe because they get more classic symptoms, and so they know that this is an impending problem. But I would say
I mean the mistake they make is that they drive themselves to the hospital rather than calling an ambulance to get treatment on the way.
Yes.
So time is lost.
But for women, it's the hesitation of maybe, you know, it's indigestion or I'm tired or fatigued and things, not realizing that for women, there can be atypical symptoms like jaw pain or pain in the shoulder and the back. But if you know and you're aware, like through these kind of forums, through your show, that you should be more aware that perhaps this is much more significant and time matters, to get me to the emergency room, get intervention. And if it turns out to be that it was indigestion because you shouldn't have been eating that meatball grinder, it's okay. That was really okay. It's better to go and better be safe than sorry.
A life is saved.
Yeah.
So better to make a mistake even several times, you're saying, if you. But do you hear that range of symptoms and how confusing it is for everybody?
Absolutely.
Men too.
Yeah.
And I think the main thing is it's never a mistake to have it evaluated.
Absolutely.
You know, finding the cause is the most important thing. You know, if this is a new symptom that you normally don't have, okay, find out what's going on because, you know, the worst thing, you have to take Tums for a while.
Right.
Well, where are we on time? Okay, let's open the phones quickly. I'm sorry, 203-776-WNPR. Michelle, is that Michelle or Michael? Michael. Hi, Michael.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, go ahead, Michael.
Hi, you were having a conversation about lifestyle choices as being the first choice, diet and exercise, instead of statins for people at a young age. But over the last 30 or 40 years, we know that people have become much more sedentary and their diet has become much worse on average. So wouldn't it be appropriate for some young people to take statins because they're inactive and have a poor diet? In other words, they're unable to change.
I think, just real quick, I think we don't focus on it as healthcare providers. You know, there are certain ones who do talk about exercise and diet, but in general, we don't. We kind of just say, okay, don't worry about it. We'll just put you on a statin. Because you look at all the guidelines, you know, for cholesterol, they still mention focusing on the lifestyle component for about the first 6 months before even putting them on a statin.
What I would add to that, Michael, is that if you have a risk factor for heart disease, say you have diabetes and you're a young age, a type 2 diabetic, that's equivalent to having heart disease and you should be on statins. Some argue that even if you're pre-diabetic and have lots of risk factors, you have hypertension, low HDL cholesterol, smoking, that's within the realm of the discussion you can have with your provider to do statins. I just think it's always important to have that conversation with the patient, to have counseling sessions to say, where are you in your pattern of change, to say that these behaviors, whether you're smoking, you're not exercising, your food choices don't really reflect perhaps your value, that those need to be addressed first, and then we can discuss the statins if we need to.
Thank you, Michael. Dr. Rodriguez, quickly, if heart disease is the number one killer, should insurance companies make it possible for everybody to see a cardiologist in addition to a regular internist?
I think that most insurance companies would allow that. It would really be the primary care physician to make the referral if they felt that that was justified. So I don't think that's an obstruction at all. Like my primary care physician who sent the patient to me, Clara, to me, that's perfectly in the realm of clinical practice. Where I thought you might be going is actually strengthening, seeing a nutritionist, because sometimes if you're trying to do that for prevention, they're not so keen on that. But you have to have a diagnosis, like, say, type 2 diabetes. You get to see a nutritionist maybe once or twice, and I think that should change.
See, that sounds counterintuitive. Yes. It sounds more expensive to wait, doesn't it?
Right, to have that angioplasty versus having, a discussion about nutritional changes.
Boy, Brad, I bet you have a lot to say about that.
Yeah, I have more job security than anybody I know.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. Brad Biskup runs UConn's Health Lifestyle Medicine Program. That's part of the Calhoun Cardiology Center. Thank you very much, Brad. And Dr. Annabel Rodriguez is the Roth Chair for Cardiovascular Research at UConn Health and a professor and genetics specialist at UConn Health. Thank you both so much for being on the show. As always, this show is about the richness of life and the books, people, recipes, value wines we talk about on the show, and the statins are at foodschmooze.org or the Faith Middleton Show. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.